The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
Welcome to the Space Show. 90 minutes of exploring new frontiers and exciting opportunities in outer space. Here's your host, Dr. David Livingston.
Hello, everybody. This is your host, David Livingston. Welcome to the Sunday Space Show. Just a reminder for everybody that this program is live on the IBC Radio Network, as well as the Lou Gentili Network and Live365.com on the Internet. By the way, IBC is a public company. You might want to check it out on the NASDAQ. Its symbol is IBCS. Let me tell you how you can participate in our show today. You can call us. We have a toll-free number. It is 1-866-687-7223. As always, email is available using either dmlivings@yahoo.com or drspace@thespaceshow.com. And for those of you working with AOL's Instant Messenger, our screen name is Space Show Chat, all one word. Also, a quick reminder, visit thespaceshow.com. All of our programs are archived there. You can listen to them whenever you want. You can click on the big button for really cool Space Show gear. And also, our newsletter is there. It is updated every Monday. You can subscribe to the newsletter, and if we have important announcements during the week, the newsletter gets updated there first. We have a great show planned for you today. John Chirp is with us, and he is the current director of the Space Frontier Foundation. He is a current director of the Space Frontier Foundation, and he is the head of the foundation's Message and Policy Committee. In this position, he writes press releases and makes policy statements. John has been involved in space advocacy since his early teens, starting with the L5 Society. He has presented at lots of space conferences on many subjects, most relating to asteroid resource exploitation. His other space advocacy efforts have focused on military space, external tank reuse, asteroid defense, and Marshall Savage's famous Millennial Project. And he has also been a participant in the ProSpace March Storm, which is a dynamite political action and involvement program. We'll ask him about that. He is an engineer, but he doesn't really work in the space industry. John Chirp, welcome to the Space Show. How are you today?
Thanks very much. I'm very good.
How did you get interested in L5 in your early teens? Most kids are not interested in space or probably didn't even know about L5 in their teens.
I'm not sure what got my attention. I just remember the space shuttle program was beginning, and I was excited to see something new coming along. I just barely, I'm old enough to remember the Apollo things, and just what most of us I found exciting.
Were there a lot of people your age in it, or were you like the only teenager involved in your area?
Oh, I think when I was a young kid, other kids were equally interested. Didn't have an opportunity to do much about it in terms of being involved when I was a teenager, so couldn't really say about that phase. I didn't get really serious about space involvement again until probably after college.
Let's talk about what the Space Frontier Foundation is and isn't, and why they issue policies and what these policies generally revolve around, and who hears these policies and what happens with them. So, maybe a quick introduction to Space Frontier Foundation.
Well, you may have heard about it in terms of its press releases and also puts on various conferences and roundtables in Congress and any number of things as the mobile teams require. But we think of ourselves as a media and policy organization first and foremost. So that is, we're not trying to be a big membership organization. We don't try to get thousands of members. We don't have chapters all over the country. We mostly try to influence opinion makers and government officials. Also, cultural influences, like people in Hollywood, who have an opportunity to really change the public's understanding of not only space, but what the potential is of things in space. So we try to concentrate our efforts on media people, Hollywood people, Washington people, and anyone else who's interested in that mix.
Overall, what do you think the response is in Congress to the policy statements that you issue? I would imagine Congress is probably the most important recipient of the policy statements that the foundation offers. Is that probably a correct statement?
Well, I think that's certainly true lately, only because Congress lately has a big interest in space and seems to acknowledge it's time to rethink things and do something different. That certainly wasn't true for most of the history of our foundation. So, like a lot of space activists, I think we have often have the feeling of beating our heads against a wall and not getting much in terms of a visible result in Washington, anyway. That seems to be changing now. We seem to hear a lot of people in Washington echoing the things we've been saying, and not just in Washington.
Well, there's so much to talk about regarding possible policies and what to do. We have the Columbia accident report and the accident itself. We have what to do with the shuttle program. We have NASA's efforts to do an orbital space plane. We have the space station sitting up there with a two-person crew that is probably as close to being useless right now as anything, as it's being babysat. A lot of people want to privatize space. And we have a world where defense and security considerations are gobbling up the budgets of most of the Western nations. And space is not probably going to see much of an increase in budgets, if any at all. So, and NASA is on the hot seat. So let's just start with NASA. Overall, they got really hit with the accident and the report doesn't seem to give them a lot of leeway and grace for being nice people here. What do you think the overall effect is ultimately going to be? Are we going to see NASA with business as usual, or do you think there really will be some fundamental changes, not just in their policies, but also in their visions and their program?
Well, I think truly significant change will only come if it's imposed from the outside. I think the current administrator is kind of a strange element in all this, in that he came in not particularly having a vision, but not particularly interested in keeping them the way they are either. So he was the first one who held their feet to the fire on making good on their promises. What disturbs me that I've noticed lately that I haven't heard anyone else comment on is that when I hear Donald Keith quoted in his statements to NASA employees, I keep hearing that he's telling them to expect the worst, to be ready for a recurring report and so forth. It sounds to me like he's kind of saying batten down the hatches. I don't hear him being quoted as saying things like get ready to implement whatever the board recommends. I don't hear him saying be ready to do whatever the board says because we're going to make a commitment to doing it and whatever it takes. I don't hear anything like that. I just hear, oh, it's going to be really bad, so stand by for something really bad. Well, great, but who's going to take the leadership to actually make sure that they do what the board recommends, which they emphatically did not do on the Challenger accident, as this report makes very clear.
But it appears that NASA is being entrusted to police itself, and of course the public statements that it makes, and there was a statement that came out the other day about the shuttle possibly being able to fly again in early next year, and already what NASA has done to comply with the reports and will be doing. So publicly the image is that NASA has learned its lesson. It is not a return to business as usual, and don't anybody worry about us. We're going to be just fine.
Well, the board that investigated this explicitly addressed the matter of can you leave NASA to just fix itself through reforms and so forth, like they tried to after Challenger, and they made it clear in no uncertain terms that they don't trust NASA to do that. They don't think that will work. But I have to say that if you're in NASA, it's kind of hard to say what else they ought to be doing until they get more specific direction from somewhere outside, from the people who are supposed to be their bosses. So between the White House and Congress, somebody else has to step forward and say, okay, we're going to do this, we're not going to do that. I point out the fact that Ronald Reagan did better than this after Challenger. He at least stepped forward and said, okay, we'll put these people in charge, we're going to make whatever fixes they say, and, oh, by the way, I don't like the fact that you guys were under this artificial schedule pressure because you're trying to launch commercial satellites, therefore I, the president, am going to just decree that you're no longer even going to try to do that, because I don't think it's right for the program, and And that's the sort of thing that we need here. Someone who shows some leadership and will take a little bit of initiative. I assume the Bush White House eventually will, but in the meantime, I don't know what NASA is supposed to do, but kind of plan around and say, well, okay, we'll make these little fixes that the board talked about.
Do you think there is any type of visionary leadership at this point coming from either the White House or any of the specific people in Congress? I know in the alternative world, everyone wants to point to Senator Nelson and Senator McCain and say they're the big allies of space. Everybody write to them, get your views out to them. But I don't see any real visionary type of statements or leadership even coming from them. Do you?
No, I don't. I haven't paid close attention to them because in the past it seems to me that they're just part of the establishment. They're part of the thing people set up the system about the shuttle and space station, the priorities, deciding how much they'd fund and how much they wouldn't fund. Congress cannot be a radical solution here because they've been in bed with NASA and creating this situation for all these years, if not decades. The people who are new on the block are the people in the White House. I wish I knew what to make of them a little bit more. I get tantalizing clues that make me feel kind of encouraged, but I don't see the big results yet. For example, when they came into office, Donald Rumsfeld going over to defense right after he had been part of a space commission, he's clearly a guy who's space literate, who understands its importance, at least from the military standpoint, and who you'd expect to be an advocate of radical change if that's what it takes. But how busy has he been with the war? Has he really been able to devote attention to space? We still don't know. We went to the Office of Science and Technology Policy at the White House, which is one kind of in charge of hospital these kinds of policy reviews. And we actually had our chairman sit down, Bob Milton, the chairman of the foundation, actually got to sit down with them and go over with them our carefully considered recommendations about space transportation policy in general. This was actually before Columbia was lost. And there was our opportunity to talk to them about let's make a commercial industry, let's get past the shuttle, let's make this situation something more like where the commercial airline industry, where ordinary people can get into space for a reasonable price, instead of the government operating the system, owning the spacecraft and deciding all the design decisions and so forth, and not even offering lives for any amount of money. We talked about all this. We got kind of a, well, as Bob told us, we didn't even get a clear idea from them about how receptive they were. They just kind of listened politely, and we weren't sure if we were making any headway or not. One encouraging thing that has happened since then is that they came out with their first policy, which was not about space in general like we were anticipating. I mean, that's the big one that we were waiting for results on. But before that happened, they came out with the results of their review of policy on remote sensing. This turned out to be much more encouraging than we ever thought. It's much more significant. I didn't think that'd be a big deal at all, but when they came out with that policy, it turned out to be just wonderful in terms of promoting commercial alternatives to government space efforts. And it was just like a dream as far as everything you can ask for in terms of remote sensing. Like, right? That's a narrow area of space policy, but they sure did a wonderful job on that one. So it's very encouraging for what they might be receptive to on the larger issue of space transportation in general.
Since we're talking about remote sensing, what do you think about the European program to have their own remote sensing projects? I believe it's Galileo. Do you think that there's enough room for another system?
Their GPS?
Yeah, their GPS, which would be used for this.
Well, it bothers me that they're doing that because they obviously don't have the money to be doing a lot of things that they ought to be doing for our security partnerships. Whenever we talk to them about important defense-related matters, every time we try to do a joint operation or peacekeeping together, keep having problems where the radios aren't up to speed or they don't have the computers to do this, the technology to do that. They always say, well, we don't have enough money. Well, okay, but if that's the case, then for them to be spending money on a totally redundant navigation constellation, it bothers me. It's certainly their right. I mean, I want us to treat them like adults if they really want to do it. No one can tell them they can't because it's frankly none of our business, but it gets to be our business when they come to us later and say, oh, we didn't have money to do what we said we would do, not only what we ought to, but what we said we would do for upgrading our military to make it more compatible with yours and interoperable with yours.
Or even participate in UN type of peacekeeping missions or other things that certainly benefit them, they won't spend the money for.
Yeah, and although we understand that space and defense are not the same thing, ultimately they came from the same government, the same taxpayers. They're making these choices deliberately, and it's another sign to me that they're really not very serious about being partners with us on security matters. So it's not the only sign, it's just another one.
We need to take a break, and when we come back, let's just jump in and start talking about the space shuttle and what we might be able to do with the space shuttle program, both now and medium and long term. So everybody stay right where you are. We will be back with John Chirp in about 2 minutes.
The Space Show would like to take a moment to thank each of you for listening and giving this program both praise and support. The Space Show, like other talk radio programs, depends upon advertisers and sponsors for their help and financial support. Tell your favorite business about the great advertising opportunities still available on The Space Show. Our ad packages are affordable, creative, and effective. They include web links and advertising, streaming internet play, as well as our very own internet radio station, in combination with your ad, on the Tuesday evening KKNW Seattle Space Show broadcast. Ad packages can be customized to fit your budget, and we know that we can have a positive impact on your business. For more information about advertising or sponsoring the Space Show, call Dr. Livingston at 415-435-6018 or send an email to drspace@thespaceshow.com. The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all mankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, economy, and our cosmic vision, one in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future afforded by offered opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility in our off-Earth conduct and the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the reality of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everyone. This is your host of The Space Show, David Livingston. Our guest today is John Chirp, and in just a second, we're going to resume talking about the space shuttle and probably connecting it to what's going on with the International Space Station. Again, you can call and participate in the show toll-free 1-866-687-7223 or use email at drspace@thespaceshow.com or instant messenger chat. The screen name is Space Show Chat. John, we've got just a few shuttles left, and they're never going to be cost-effective or efficient. They're probably never going to be really safe no matter what they do with them. They probably belong in the Smithsonian. What should we do with this program? It's really the only way we can even get to the space station, let alone get into space.
Well, it is because we make it that way, because we deliberately limited ourselves. All the things that you could say about the shuttle, about it's the only thing that can do this and the best thing is to do that, well, for now, NASA set up that way because they want it that way. They want the shuttle to justify the station to justify the shuttle. They're really like twin millstones around the neck of the nation's space effort. And what we ought to be doing is asking ourselves, how quickly can we stop flying the shuttles forever? NASA isn't even thinking those terms. They don't even put any effort into offering the shuttle. We need to ask ourselves, do we need to fly shuttles anymore at all? Now, even Administrator Sean O'Keefe admitted before Congress and testimony to the House Science Committee, he admitted that the space station doesn't really need anybody aboard for as long as a whole year. It could go without any crew at all. Now, we keep getting conflicting information from NASA. On one hand, they'll admit this sort of thing under certain circumstances, but most of the time they go on saying, well, you got to have not only astronauts, but you got more astronauts so we can get things done and so forth. I'll also point out when Dennis Tito went up to the space station, that was an instance in which he had one crew member who was aboard who was doing nothing but looking out the window, enjoying the view, and taking pictures for his photo album. Not only did he not help out on the space station, NASA wouldn't let him help out because they didn't want him to touch anything. They went even further than that. They made such a jerk about it that they assigned one of their own astronauts at any given time to be basically watching Dennis Tito to make sure he didn't touch anything. So despite the fact this is a grown man who'd actually worked for NASA, an engineer, a successful businessman, very responsible man, and was, I guess, in his 60s, they basically decided to babysit him. So that means that they had another astronaut who was not doing anything useful. And yet, at the same time, they try to tell us that, well, they got to have more astronauts aboard in order to accomplish anything or even just keep the thing running. So we get conflicting information from them. And I'm not prepared to say which is the actual case because I'm not an expert with Bob, but I don't think we've gotten the real story from them. So obviously the thing can go with fewer people or even no people at all for quite some time. It could really go for a year with no astronauts aboard. And remember, the shuttle isn't the only way to get them there. If you think they need to be there, we're going to still use the Soyuz. But if we don't really need to have anyone out there for as much as a year or so, we could be spending that year developing other things to eliminate our dependence on the shuttle. Now, at this point, people say, well, see, certain pieces of the space station can only be lifted by the shuttle. Well, that's because they're designed that way. And you can redesign things, and you can, if necessary, just, for example, take equipment out of modules and launch them separately and then reassemble them in space. That's what NASA already had decided to do in the case of the American laboratory. There are ways of doing things if you're interested in trying. NASA's not interested in trying, and no one's making them go down that path at this point.
I have a related question that has come in from email. This is as good a time as any to bring it up. It's from Roger in Houston, and he says, John, how can we afford to mothball the space station given the presence of international partners, most with different agendas and different needs, and not really caring about the U.S. economy or the U.S. space shuttle problems? Plus, look at the huge investment the public sector here in America has in the space station. How could we ever afford to let that thing sit idle?
Well, that's a really key point, and I wish we had a whole hour to devote to just that question. There's so much I want to say about it. In fact, what I'm thinking of doing is making a frequently asked questions section on our foundation website so people can go there and look at it for just this sort of thing. It's not there yet, but it'll give me a week or so. Maybe you'll see it up there. Okay, how can we afford to mothball? Well, NASA sticks us with this problem very deliberately, you understand.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, at this point, the station is supposed to be about half finished. The investment is pretty eye-watering already, and we ought to try to salvage it. Mothballing it is different from just abandoning it or letting it burn up. I like the idea of mothballing it, putting it into a higher orbit, and waiting for us to get a more reasonable capability for servicing it. Let me point out some things about the space shuttle. The shuttle, people talk about, well, it has unique capabilities and so forth. Well, it does, but we don't necessarily need those unique capabilities forever. The shuttle is basically a miniature space station of its own because it was built at a time when we knew we wouldn't have an actual space station to go to. It was kind of made like a recreational vehicle that can go out in the woods where there are no facilities. In other words, there isn't a hotel to stay at, so you have to bring everything with you. You have to have your own little bathroom, your own beds to sleep in, your own kitchen, and all the rest. And the space shuttle, they have their power systems and so forth. It was a basic space station that could go up for a week or two at a time and then come back. Well, now that we have a space station, we don't need the shuttle to be a space station of its own, and we certainly don't need a shuttle to be designed and built to go up and be the same thing this one has been. So it just kills me when people still talk about what's make a shuttle replacement. We don't need a shuttle replacement. We don't need the shuttle. We've got a space station. What we need are cheap ways of launching cargo into space, of launching people into space, and of doing things of interacting between them. Let me point out the space station not only has astronauts aboard and the ability to host personnel, but also has a manipulator arm that is already installed on. This is to perform much the same function as the one on the space shuttle. So that's one more thing about the space shuttle that isn't really unique and isn't necessarily needed. As long as we have that, we then really have the problem of getting large pieces of cargo up to the space station and mated with it, and that requires human interaction. So let's think about the problem. If we didn't have a shuttle, how would we do all these things? Well, we have large launchers, unmanned launchers, that can boost large pieces of the space station with things. If they're currently not quite capable, we can either change the rockets or we can change the payload until we've got a match. Right now, we've got a situation where the heavy boosters in the U.S. of the Titans and the EELV. Well, the Titans we've stopped making. I don't think we've launch all the ones that we bought, but we stop making them. And the ones that we bought, I think, are dedicated to probably Air Force payloads. Even if you talk about maybe stealing one from the Air Force, ultimately that's not a long-term solution. We really need to build the EELD. And I wish they'd come up with a better name for that damn thing. I'm so sick of this awkward acronym, EELD. But the ones that are being made today, the first EELDs are just the small versions. We need to build up to the so-called heavy version. At that point, we'll be able to have an equivalent replacement for the Titan. Okay, so now we can lift large pieces of cargo into space. Once we get them there, that is not good enough to get them to the space station because those launchers can't position them precisely enough to rendezvous with the space station. This is the kind of thing that the shuttle has done for us in the past. Well, if we don't have the shuttle, what do we need? We need something that can just tug things around in space, called a space tug. NASA already developed one of these, conceptually. They're actually planning to build one in the early 1980s. They have a contract like the TRW. They had a fairly finalized design. It was abandoned for various reasons. That could be resurrected or something newer and better. Once you've got that in space, and keep in mind, this is an unmanned system, do by remote control. If you launch the modules, like the Columbia Lab or the Japanese Kaibo, you launch them on an ELD or an Ariane or something, take your space tug, have that hauled over the space station, do the fine maneuvering to get in its position. It doesn't even have to dock with the space station, which would be tricky if you're doing by remote control. Remember, the space station has that manipulator arm. It's got astronauts aboard. They can grab pieces, assemble it. So what did you need the space shuttle for? Not necessarily much of anything. If we put our minds to it, if we say that we've got a function here of maneuvering things in space precisely that we need to replace, we don't need the space shuttle to do that.
A couple of points, but first keep your telephone as close to your mouth as possible so we can keep the audio up. What do you think the reaction would be from the international partners and especially the Russians if we did decide to mothball the station because of our U.S. objectives and goals, and if we said, you know, no more of this space shuttle or even orbital space plane stuff, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, this is how we're going to access and deal with the station. And, I mean, we do have some sort of a partnership with all these different nations. Could they veto all of this? Could they say, to hell with this, we're not doing this? Could they pull out and make us pay everybody's share? I mean, right now we're paying Russia's share.
Get out with that easily. I'd jump at that opportunity. they can't make us fly shuttles if we don't want to, but I agree with you totally. We have commitments. We shouldn't break them. As much fun as it would be to really poke our finger in the eye of certain of our European partners at the moment, we have other people who are still good partners who we deserve to make good on our promises. And no, we can't unilaterally decide to mothball the stations, but we can decide that we're going to fulfill our obligations in different ways. Our obligations are not to fly a space shuttle. Our obligations are to get cargo and people to the stations in a various timeline. Mothballing, we present this as an option, and if they have a better idea, if they have other ways that they're willing to implement to get station personnel and modules to the station by other means, that's fine. We certainly want to work with them and be flexible. I think we ought to offer mothballing as a temporary solution, not to throw it away, but as a way of just deferring the completion of the station, making it more affordable to use it when it's completed.
Well, you know, who knows? But I want to tell you this. I was at the Mars Society conference in Eugene, Oregon a couple of weeks ago. And there was a presentation by a gentleman from Boeing, and I don't have his name right here, but if it's important and you want to know, I'll look it up in the book during the next break. And he talked about the orbital space plane, and he talked about it from the point of view that more than likely, almost guaranteed, hey, this is our perception, and Boeing's going to get the contract, although it's going to be between Boeing and Lockheed, so most people say, ho-hum, what's the big difference anyway, especially since Boeing and Lockheed are maintaining the shuttle. And I have to tell you that the room was really packed. I mean, there were probably maybe a half, if not two-thirds, of all those attending the Mars Society conference were in this particular session, and it was being followed by Bob Zubrin, who was going to talk about nuclear power in space and the NASA program for Project Prometheus. especially as it relates to Mars. So everybody was in, you know, to follow one program right into the other. The audience reaction to the Boeing guy was just phenomenally cynical. It was ho-hum. Who can believe this? But some of the things he was talking about were not only how fast they could have it made, which was probably 10 years, but maybe if budget is not such a big concern, they might be able to do something in 8 years. They're talking about $12-13 billion, and the mission of this thing is to carry not too many astronauts to and from the station, and that is its mission. I mean, what a boondoggle. And the people in the room were just like, okay, we're going to be polite to you, but that's about it. So Bob comes up, and you know, the first 5 or 10 minutes of Bob's talk is about the orbital space plane and how it's more likely going to be in the neighborhood of $17-18 billion. It's totally unnecessary. This is not the way we need to be going for space access, not even for NASA, and they can't be permitted to, you know, to contract and design this type of a vehicle. And then he went into his nuclear power discussion, which is a different thing. And I know the foundation has a position on the orbital space plane, and I don't see how they can, in a straight face, John, say we're going to spend $12-13 billion, $10 billion, whatever it is, and design a damn vehicle that has such a limited scope of operation. What in the hell are these guys doing? It's not comprehensible in the rational world.
Well, it doesn't even matter how much money you throw at it. I've got to point out that all the evidence, and I mean all of it, from the late 1970s when the tunnel was completed, shows that NASA no longer knows how to build a vehicle and really got to fly. They have not completed one flyable vehicle in all that time. All the X programs and so forth, none of them have gotten off the ground, literally. To now bet on the OSP, to assume that it will be completed, that the design will be successful, that they'll actually get it going on schedule, meet all the requirements and so forth, you know, you've got to be just beyond naive to put faith in that. The cost is completely outrageous, of course. What we need to do is take not that money, but a fraction of that money, offer it to the private sector and say, hey, look, here's what our requirements are. And by the private sector, you might be saying, well, Boeing is a private company. Well, okay, but if their price is $17 billion, then fine, that's their bid. Now we'll see if any reasonable company can come in and do the job for the same amount of money. And I'll bet that there's somebody who can. All you have to do is offer it. I mean, the worst that happens is they come back and say, no, we can't do it. Boeing is right. It really does cost that much money. We're no worse off. But we ought to take, say, $5 billion and just kind of troll it out there through industry and say, hey, can anyone make a lousy 4- to 6-man personnel transfer thing that can get to this orbit and do it within, say, 5 years? So the schedule is what really kills me on this. Even if Boeing could do it and do it for that amount of money, or even for a much less amount of money, if it really takes that much time, people, you know how long space stations are been up there? Space station was begun in 1998. You know what the design lifetime was? 10 years. It's halfway through its design lifetime already. When these people talk about we'll spend another 10 years or so just to make the stupid OSP, what's it going to be going to?
Well, they'll keep the station up there just like Russia kept Mir going and probably should have kept Mir going.
Oh, but yeah, and of course they will. We all know that. But what NASA's not done is they've not been honest with Congress. They've not said that stuff we told you about a 10-year operational lifetime and expense. We were lying. We want to keep it going for another 5 or 10 years after that. And by the way, here's what the bill would be. So your total cost of space is now even more by many billions of dollars. They've not come clean about that. Congress really needs to sick the OMB or someone on them, or the White House needs to do that, and find out what the real truth is.
And, of course, that doesn't even include finishing the space station so that it becomes a useful vehicle.
Well, it's never going to be what it should have been. I'm not saying it was a dumb idea from the beginning because it wasn't, but it changed so many times over the years, and they wasted so much money. Like, I wonder what the hell did Boeing do with all that money that they were getting? It's like train loads of money. And somehow we're still only halfway completed on the thing. And trivia question for your audience. Do you know when the space station was supposed to be completed? When it was originally proposed back in 1984. So you youngsters out there who may be listening, in case you don't know, the president back then was Ronald Reagan, and in fact it was his first term in office, and he's the one who in 1984 gave NASA to go ahead to start making the space station. It was supposed to be done by 1992.
And it was going to be freedom, right?
Yeah. Well, eventually they decided, you know, they would call it freedom. Now, the Wonder Building today is not the same, and there are some, the reasons for that, some of them are good, some not so good. But the thing is already 11 years overdue. If they finish it tomorrow, the Magic Genie grant them wish, and they finish it tomorrow, it's still 11 years late. And the schedule we're actually on is going to be more like 15 years, 20, take a guess. How late it is, it's going to involve a lot of extra money that Congress is not being told about, and they might just decide this isn't worth it. They might go to international partners and say, hey, we know we made a commitment and we want to have something, but is this worth it to you? Even if we follow them to take this venture, are you willing to do this? They may not be. They might prefer some other option. Like, maybe the Japanese would say, well, let's make a different space station in a more convenient orbit that we can get to more cheaply, and we'll put just our module and a couple of these other modules together, and we'll build off of that, and that'll be like the second space station, and the Russians can stay with the one they've got now and just serve it with Soyuz. And maybe Europeans will they're going to the Japanese or make the third space station. Who knows?
Don't you think Congress really knows what the bottom line is here, and that they're not getting the total information from NASA, and they're just not asking for it, but they really know in their heart of hearts that this thing is almost a bottomless pit.
It's a money pit. Well, I assume that they know that. Now, there's some turnover in Congress. They don't have exactly the same people year for year, but I would hope that they finally got the incentive to do something about this. Let me point out something in the CAVE report. I don't want to go too far from the shuttle here. Early on, it talks about how the people on the shuttle program, they kind of cut corners and didn't do all the engineering analysis and so forth that they should have done. And it says in here something that I thought was very significant that I'd like to point out under Chapter 6. In fact, if you just go to the synopsis on page 12 or thereabouts, it talks about intense pressure the program was under to stay on schedule, driven largely by the self-imposed requirements to complete the International Space Station. The two key words there are self-imposed. That's incredibly significant. Now, if we read down in the report, what they're mostly talking about is how Sean O'Keefe held their feet to the fire on their initial schedule, but basically the schedule that they had when they came into that position, and said, well, okay, don't slip anymore, keep your promises. That became worse and worse as tasks slipped, kind of have a bow wave of tasks building up ahead of them that they just couldn't complete by that time, and eventually something broke, and that was the Columbia mission. But the self-imposed thing is extremely important. It's not just that O'Keefe imposed that requirement that they not slip anymore. It's really the space station as a whole has been a self-imposed thing that NASA came up with. Yeah, they got President Reagan to agree with it once upon a time, but I seriously doubt that that's the reason they're continuing to pursue the ISS. I don't think Reagan's at home really worrying about it. What are they going to do? Come to him and say, okay, we finally met our commitment to you? President Reagan, I don't think so. I mean, they're doing it for their own reasons. And what you see in the report, although the gaming people don't lean on it. They don't seem to really notice it in their own writing. They do it kind of unselfconsciously. But they talk about NASA's rationale to justify NASA's proposals and NASA's projects to fulfill NASA's vision. Oh, excuse me, wasn't it supposed to be our space program? This is all NASA put itself under pressure to complete a project because NASA felt like doing so. Now, they didn't have the money to do it right, not when you include the space shuttle. And James Oberg, in a column recently, he wrote that source, which he didn't name, from within NASA, came to him and made a comment, which I thought was one of the best ones, which is that, yep, that nobody in NASA had the guts to go to Congress and say, well, if that's all the money you've got, then we're not going to fly. You know, that's exactly what they should have done, and if they had, Congress's proper response should have been, okay, let's not fly, because we don't have that much money, and it isn't worth it to us. Oh, remember what we used to say, no Buck Rogers? Well,
absolutely.
So why were they still trying to be Buck Rogers, still trying to push this space station, which nobody really wanted? It's not like the public was clamoring for this International Space Station. I shouldn't speak in the past tense. We're really talking about the president also. They weren't clamoring for it. Congress they kind of wanted, they had their commitments and so forth, and it bought votes in the appropriate congressional districts and so forth. But it's not like it was a major priority for Congress. It's been through several presidential administrations of both parties. It was not a major thing for any of them either. Connell Keith didn't particularly care about it, I don't think. So why was NASA pushing people to this standing? And you read the report, it's really incredible. They not only were like working weekends and holidays to meet the schedule, but they put the second shift on, and then they wanted to put a third shift on, so they didn't have a third shift. So what they went out and hired an entire new shift of people, which you have to train, of course, just to keep after the schedule that they imposed on themselves. Why? This is crazy. We've got a loose cannon agency that's just totally out of control, pursuing its own agenda.
I've got a question that is related to this. It comes from King in Seattle. And he says, both of you have talked about the private sector. Realistically, are there any private companies that can aggressively bid or build an orbital space plane other than those that comprise the large aerospace industry? If there are such companies and they are real, who are they? I'm not talking about suborbital companies. That is a completely different mission and scope. Who can actually build an orbital space vehicle other than the large aerospace industry companies?
Well, at the moment, there's no one.